Aya chakshulamritam jena tasmai sri gurave namaha sri chaitana manubistam stapitam jena bhutale svaiham rupakadam mayam dadati svapandantikam om namo bhagavate vasudevaya
om namo bhagavate vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 12, Text Number 20. Esha Data Sharanyash Cha Yata Hi Aushinaraha Shibi Shibihi Yasho Vitanita Svanam Daushyantir Eva Yajvanam Esha Data Sharanyascha Yata Hyaushaninara Shibihi Yata Hyaushinaraha Shibihi Yasho Vitanita Svanam Doshyantir Eva Yajnanam. Donor in charity. Sharanyaha. Protector of the surrendered. Cha. And. Yataha. As. He, certainly, Aushinaraha, the country named Aushinaraha, Shibi, Yashaha, fame, Vitanita, disseminator, Svanam, of the kinsman, Doshyantihi, Eva, like Bharata, the son of Dushyanta. Yajvanam, of those who have performed many sacrifices. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. This child will be a munificent donor of charity and protector of the surrendered, like the famous king Shibi of the Aushinara country. And he will expand the name and fame of his family like Bharata, the son of Maharaja Dushyanta. Purport. A king becomes famous by his acts of charity, performances of yajnas, protection of the surrendered, etc. A Kshatriya king is proud to give protection to the surrendered souls. This attitude of a king is called Ishvara Bhav, or factual power, to give protection in a righteous cause. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord instructs living beings to surrender unto Him, and He promises all protection. The Lord is all-powerful and true to His word, and therefore He never fails to give protection to His different devotees. The king, being the representative of the Lord, must possess his attitude of giving protection to the surrendered souls at all risk. Maharaj Shibi, the king of Aushinara, was an intimate friend of Maharaj Yati, who was able to reach the heavenly planets along with Maharaj Shibi. Maharaj Shibi was aware of the heavenly planet where he was to be transferred after his death, and the description of his heavenly planet is given in Mahabharata, Adiparva 96, points 6 through 9. Maharaj Shibi was so charitably disposed that he wanted to give over his acquired position in the heavenly kingdom to Yayati, but he did not accept it. Yayati went to the heavenly planet along with the great rishis like Astaka and others. On an inquiry from the rishis, Yayati gave an account of Shibi's pious acts when all of them were on the path to heaven. He has become a member of the assembly of Yamaraj, who has become his worshipful deity. As confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, the worshipper of the demigods goes to the planets of the demigods, Yanti Deva Vrata Devan. So Maharaj Shibi has become an associate of the great Vaishnava authority Yamaraj on the particular planet. While he was on the earth, he became very famous as a protector of surrendered souls and a donor of charity. The king of heaven once took the shape of a pigeon hunter bird, an eagle, and Agni, the fire god, took the shape of a pigeon. The pigeon, while being chased by the eagle, took shelter on the lap of Maharaj Shibi, and the hunter eagle wanted the pigeon back from the king. The king wanted to give it some other meat to eat and requested the bird not to kill the pigeon. The hunter bird refused to accept the king's offer, but it was settled later on that the eagle would accept flesh from the body of the king of the pigeon's equivalent weight. The king began to cut flesh from his body to weigh in the balance equivalent to the weight of the pigeon, but the mystic pigeon always remained heavier. The king then put himself on the balance to equate with the pigeon, and the demigods were pleased with him. The king of heaven and the fire god disclosed their identity, and the king was blessed by them. Devarishi Narada, who also glorified Maharaj Shibi for his great achievements, specifically in charity and protection. Maharaj Shibi sacrificed his own son for the satisfaction of human beings in his kingdom, and thus child Parikshit was to become a second Shibi in charity and protection. Dushyanti Bharata. There are many Bharatas in history, of which Bharata, the brother of Lord Ram, Bharata, the son of King Rishabha, and Bharata, the son of Maharaj Dushyanta, are very famous, and all of these Bharatas are historically known to the universe. This earth planet is known as Bharata or Bharata Varsa, due to the king Bharata, the son of Rishabha, but according to some, this land is known as Bharata due to the reign of the son of Dushyanta. So far, we are convinced this land's name, Bharatavarsa, was established from the reign of Bharata, the son of King Rishabha. Before him, the land was known as Ilavritavarsa, but just after the coronation of Bharata, the son of Rishabha, this land became famous as Bharatavarsa. But despite all of this, Bharata, the son of Maharaj Dushyanta, was not less important. He is the son of the famous beauty, Shakuntala. Maharaj Dushyanta fell in love with Shakuntala in the forest, and Bharata was conceived. After that, Maharaj forgot his wife Shakuntala by the curse of Kanva Muni, and the child Bharata was brought up in the forest by his mother. Even in his childhood, he was so powerful that he challenged the lions and elephants in the forests and would fight with them as little children play with cats and dogs. Because of the boys becoming so strong, more than the so-called modern Tarzan, the rishis in the forest called him Sarvadamana, or one who is able to control everyone. A full description of Maharaj Bharata is given in Mahabharata, Adiparva. The Pandavas or the Kurus are sometimes addressed as Bharata due to their being born in the dynasty of the famous Maharaj Bharata, the son of King Dushyanta. So this is a glorification of Maharaja Parikshit. Not an idol glorification, because, as we know, Maharaj Parikshit lived to fulfill whatever was spoken about him. So far as his strength is concerned, we can only appreciate how powerful Parikshit Maharaj was by the fact that when the personality of Kali came before him, he was extremely fearful. We know that Kali is all-powerful. Everyone is suffering in the throes of the Kali Yuga. And yet, this personality, Kali, was so fearful that he would shake when he came before the Emperor Parikshit. Emperor Parikshit was actually a qualified emperor, unlike today's leaders. In his kingdom, there was nothing like intoxication, gambling, meat-eating, and illicit sex. He was very powerful, and he was always on guard to prevent irreligion. But today's leaders, on the other hand, are the leaders of irreligion. Unless someone is a leader of irreligion, no one will elect them. Therefore, Prabhupada said that the present type of government, which we know as democracy, is demon, he renamed democracy, demon crazy. In other words, when crazy demons or demons go more crazy than they already are, one of their symptoms is that they elect someone from amongst them who excels in their sinfulness. Whoever is the biggest sinner, Prabhupada said, just like whichever dog barks the loudest gets the most attention. So whoever is the greatest of sinners is generally elected to, you know, high administrative positions. And the result is that we are living in a society of misleaders. They are not leaders, but they are misleaders. And when blind persons follow blind leaders, the result, of course, is misfortune. So the king has a great duty to perform, and that is to give protection. Kshatriya means one who gives protection. And that protection has to be more than simply physical protection. It has to be spiritual protection. Just unfortunately today, people do not understand the necessity of spiritual life. And therefore, they think that protection simply means to keep fit, to keep the body healthy. And so we see that there is a proliferation of health clubs. And everybody, you know, belongs to a health club. Just like people used to belong to a church, now they belong to a health club. And just as they used to go to church on a regular basis, now they go to a health club. And because, what does this mean? That the object of their worship has changed. Instead of worshiping God, they're worshiping the material body. So this says something about, you know, what their consciousness must be. Prabhupada often gives the example of the body being dead. And anyone who is always focused on a dead body is like a vulture. Vultures have the tendency to always be looking for corpses. They fly very high in the air. They have the ability to see from great distances. But what are they straining to see? A dead body, a corpse. So this is the situation today. People have only the ability to protect corpses, dead bodies, but they cannot protect the living force which is within the body, namely the soul. They do not know how to protect the soul from being assaulted by all kinds of contaminating influences. And so when we live in our community and we give protection to the soul, they think that this is living in isolation, too much insulated. But actually, we are protecting ourselves like any persons who like to live in a controlled or regulated neighborhood. They want to protect themselves. We also do. But we are not satisfied to protect ourselves against, you know, so-called racial contamination or so-called, you know, ethnic contamination, so-called, you know, financial contamination of being with persons of a poorer class. None of these things are of very much interest to us. But what we see is the greatest contamination is that people who are addicted to illicit activities. And so we prefer to create a community of devotees who are following religious principles. And the result is that there's some protection. Even though we live in the midst of a big city, we don't feel as if we are in a big city when we live in a community of devotees. Our neighbors are all devotees. You know, the sounds which come out from their rooms are hopefully bhajans and not, you know, blasts of other types of music. And the smells that come out of the kitchen are the smells of prasadam being prepared, you know, rather than some dead flesh on a grill. And there are many other advantages. So we have to be protective of this atmosphere, this environment, and at the same time we have to be very charitable. These two sometimes may appear to be contradictory. On the one hand, to be protective, even to the point, as we see here, sometimes using force. Protection may be required, and it may require the use of force. It's not that the people were pacifists. I had a person come here the other day, and we were discussing something about the death penalty. And he was surprised to learn that we are in favor of the death penalty under certain circumstances. He said, oh, I thought you people were pacifists. So there's this stereotype conception that monks or religious persons automatically are against killing. Now, we are against murder, but we are not against protection. And I explained to him that actually it is a question of protection. The death penalty is protection. Who is it protection for? It's protection not only for discouraging other criminals to commit murder and other such heinous crimes, but it also is a protection for the individual. Because when someone commits a murder, the only way that they can get relief from the karma of committing a murder is to be killed themselves. And if they're not killed themselves, then they have to suffer, not only in this life, but in many lifetimes to follow. Therefore, it is an act of mercy to give the death sentence to a murderer. And this was done during Vedic times. Five causes, it mentions in the Bhagavad Gita, for which someone may be killed. Just like if someone attacks with a deadly weapon, they can be killed. If someone sets fire to one's property, they can be killed. If someone steals one's wife, they can be killed. Now, of course, we have to live within our present-day system of laws. And one time, someone did steal somebody's wife in ISKCON, and the person whose wife had been stolen went out, hunted that person down, and killed him. And, of course, then they got thrown in jail for that, and Prabhupada was very, very upset. Because Srila Prabhupada's point was that, first of all, we have to abide by the laws of the land we are living in. Besides that, the person who got killed happened to be a devotee, and not only a devotee, but one of Prabhupada's previous servants. So Prabhupada was very upset that this other person had taken the law in his own hands. We are not living any longer in Vedic times, and therefore we have to have the sense to adjust the instructions of Scripture. Not necessarily on major points. We cannot compromise on major points. For example, if someone says, well, chanting Hare Krishna really does disturb a lot of people, so let's stop chanting out loud. We can't agree to that. That type of compromise will compromise the very basis of Krishna consciousness. That's not possible. On the other hand, just like we can compromise in many different, smaller ways. You know, if we could, when we chant, for example, when we go out and chant, we are sensitive to the people's feelings and, you know, other rules. So, for example, when we go to the West End, we don't harass the horses and, you know, or the policemen or the people in general. we figure out how to chant in a way that is pleasing, not disturbing. So, Krishna consciousness missionary work requires that we do selectively modify certain aspects of what we read. And you have to be intelligent to do that. It is not whimsically done. We have our governing body, which governs our society. We have our temple administrators. We have our senior Vaishnavas. We have our gurus. And everyone has the scriptures, Prabhupada's books. Prabhupada himself makes many adjustments. When Prabhupada came here, he created an ashram for ladies, although previously there hadn't been such an ashram. But Prabhupada said if there's no ashram for the women are not protected in this day and age, so they have to have their ashram to live in. So he made an adjustment like this. He made so many adjustments, which, you know, we take for granted. Many of you don't even know some of these things are adjustments. You just take it for granted that this is the way it is. But actually it wasn't the way it was. Before Prabhupada made these adjustments, members of his Guru Maharaj's institution, they did certain things differently. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur also made adjustments. Just like this, this saffron cloth became a thing which he adapted, the sacrificial ceremonies, so many things he did to formalize the system of missionary activity. So an acharya is especially authorized to make broad changes of this type. And it's the success of the mission depends upon the proper utilization of this principle of holding the tradition strictly in place and at the same time adapting it to time, place, and circumstance. And it's a very fine balance. We've seen that if the balance is taken too far to one side, everything becomes disturbed. And on the other hand, if there's too much rigidity, then nothing spreads. So it's a very fine line. In any case, getting back to the topic on hand with Maharaj Shibi, this is a very, very wonderful example. Here is a king who was so kind and merciful that he gave shelter to a pigeon. You know, a pigeon is an insignificant bird. There are so many birds. Imagine, you know, in this situation, if you put yourself in Maharaj Shibi's shoes, you know, what would you do if a pigeon landed on your shoulder or lap or in your house, let's say, and an eagle was chasing him and the eagle said, I want that pigeon. What would you do? You'd probably say, well, that's nature's arrangement. I think that's what I would say. I'd say, you know, it's nature's arrangement. In other words, we eat vegetables, eagles eat pigeons. So it's not... there's nothing wrong with it. There's not going to be any bad karma for this eagle if he eats the pigeon, and even the pigeon's not going to get any real problem. Pigeon's not his body anyway. And he'll go on to probably the next birth will be as an eagle. And he'll eat some pigeons. And I can't worry about every single pigeon that's chased by every eagle in the world. It's not my business. I have to go out on Sankirtan, or I have to do so many other services. I can't be worried about this. But that's not what the king thought. And I mean, a king is in a much greater, bigger, much more responsible position than any one of us. And this, when we say king, we're not just talking about the mayor of a city, which is a figurehead anyway, but we're talking about a person who was actually responsible for ruling a giant kingdom. And this bird, you know, sat on him and took shelter of him. And the king was prepared, you know, as we find here, to start cutting off flesh from his own body, which is unimaginable. I mean, we can't even, it's hard to imagine. What does that mean, cutting flesh from? How do you cut flesh from your body? Your body starts to bleed all over the place, you know, and he was hacking away on his body on the principle of giving protection. This is to what degree a king was responsible. That means that the king was responsible not just to human beings. And even then, you know, where is the leader today that would do such a thing even for another human being? I mean, supposing you see a helpless person in the front of your house and there's a killer stalking that person. Are you going to go out? Would you take the risk? Supposing this killer has, you know, got a semi-automatic weapon in his hand. He's standing right outside your house and he's about to shoot this helpless person. What would you do? Would you open your door and say something? Or you, the best thing you probably would land up doing is, you know, dialing 911. And that, you know, maybe, probably that's what you do. You dial 911. But how long is it going to take for the police to come? Now, we also have experience about that. It could take a long time. Well, here's a king who would have done something about this. You know, he would have immediately jumped out front and said, you can't do this. He would have risked his life. Not just for a human being, but as we see here, he risked his life for a, you know, insignificant pigeon. Because the understanding was that Prajapati, to be a protector and a person who is the source of creatures, to give protection to all of the living entities in the kingdom, men, not just human citizens, but every type of species was protected by the king. You know, to the point of finally being willing to sacrifice his life to protect this bird. So this was a test. And probably we won't, you know, get the opportunity to take such dramatic tests as this. You know, what are our tests? And what degree, what tests do we have to pass? Well, you can think about that. I suspect that every one of us has had some opportunity to be tested in terms of mercy. Just like some fly, right, gets trapped between your window and your screen. What do? The fly is going to buzz all over the room and disturb you, especially if you're when you're sleeping, it might land on you. You know? So you could close the window and trap the fly between the screen and the window. Now you could argue, well, the fly is going to be able to breathe because there's just a screen there, he can breathe. But you know the fly can't get any food. So what are you going to do? Or cockroaches are another favorite test. How tolerant are you? Do you kill cockroaches? Do you spray bomb your house and wipe out all the cockroaches? Or mice? You know, and these are our big tests. You know, and there's no question of lopping off flesh. You know, the question is only whether we're going to kill the other living entity or not. Our act of mercy is we don't kill them. So we are a long way from Maharashibi. We're a long way. There's a great difference between ourselves and Maharaj Parikshit. These persons are heroes. Without heroes, there's no question of religion. We see that the difference is that in atheism, there is a tendency to want to do away with the hero. Just like there's a famous playwright, Bertolt Brecht, who was a German playwright, and he wrote a famous drama called Galileo. And in this drama, he has this line that, you know, something to the degree of how poor is the land that requires heroes. In other words, his idea was that there's no such thing as individual heroes. The people as a whole are heroes. But he was against the principle of glorifying one particular individual. Probably because once you start to glorify one individual, the ultimate tendency is to glorify God. So he was a communist and an atheist. How unfortunate, you know, is the land that requires heroes. But we require heroes because without heroes, we have no role models. And rather, you know, the role models become anti-heroes, persons who have horrendous behavior as the norm are considered to be heroes. Just like you see today, Look at who the heroes of the youth are. The people who appear to be grotesque, whose behavior is grotesque, abominable. You know, you have someone like, you know, Madonna. I mean, even the very name that she chose, purposely chose, you know, is such a, you know, it disgraces, in other words, the concept of a saintly, female saintly person. And her, what is, you know, her only message is sex. Have sex. And her name is Madonna. So rather than being something which conveys purity, we have something which conveys impurity. And that's called an anti-hero. So someone who has all of the qualities of the opposite of what a hero should be and is elevated to the point of worship. So we are living in a different world altogether. Again, Dushyanta and the son Bharata, Prabhupada says, who is much stronger than the so-called modern Tarzan. And this son of it is a very beautiful drama has been written by Kalidas. Kalidas, the famous playwright, Sanskrit playwright, he wrote a drama which is actually more famous than any. It is the most famous Sanskrit drama, and it is also probably more well known than the, at least nowadays, than the Bhagavatam's narration of the same story. And it is a very moving story in which the king is cursed and forgets his wife and son. And the son and wife eventually come back to the king and try to claim their rightful position. And he can't remember. So it's a whole story about this. But anyway, this boy was raised in the forest. And as a play, you know, as a game, he would play with, as it mentions here, he would play with tigers and lions and elephants. And he would defeat them. He would wrestle, in other words, with elephants. Even though he was only 10 years old, he would wrestle with elephants and pull them down and flatten them on the ground. You know, he would slap lions in the face and be fearless, and they could do nothing to him. So this Parikshit Maharaj will have that much strength. And he had such strength. Again, the tolerance which Maharaj Parikshit demonstrated by being able to not retaliate when he was cursed. If we get even slightly offended, you know, which one amongst us, who amongst us is able to just remain silent when you get offended? As soon as someone says something insulting to you, your blood begins to boil. Your hairs stand up. And, you know, angry words issue forth from your mouth. You become so upset. Now, he was cursed to die for no good reason. No good reason. And yet, he didn't do anything. He accepted it as the will of the Lord. So, we need to develop such tolerance. We also will have many occasions to be insulted, offended, you know, have acts done against us which are unjust. And we have to be tolerant. Because tolerance is required, especially as we get older. The body starts to fall apart. And if you're not very pacified and tolerant, you can't deal with that. Until eventually the ultimate disintegration of the body comes at the time of death. And if you practice tolerating, then when death comes, you won't be disturbed. Your mind will still be very focused, very fixed. So this life is a preparation. And Krishna consciousness may appear to be troublesome. We may feel it is troublesome to get up and to chant and to study and to control our eating habits and so many other things. It is troublesome. But more troublesome than all of this is having to die and take birth in an unfortunate condition. If this life is trouble, You can't imagine how much more trouble it can be when you have to take birth again and go through all kinds of miserable conditions. So, let us say it is worth the trouble. There's trouble to be taken in almost any endeavor, whatever it may be. If you, just like ladies have, husband and wife has a child, there's trouble. Trouble from childhood, from pregnancy, trouble from raising the child. The parents have to go through so much effort. In business, so much effort is required. There's barely anything which doesn't require some endeavor. So this is the most difficult thing, to put a stop to the repetition of birth and death. Maybe we will not be able to do it in one lifetime. But if we work at it, then gradually, within one or two or three or four lifetimes, whatever it may take, we'll have come to the point of full Krishna consciousness. This is what we're after. So you have to learn to be very farsighted and very determined. Just as you're trying to make this life perfect, you're be aware of the fact that we're on a marathon that may take us even beyond this lifetime. Be prepared that for birth after birth, I will struggle to become fully Krishna conscious. Then, once and for all, the business is finished. Once and for all, the business is finished. We can go back to home, back to Godhead. So we'll stop here and ask if anyone has any questions or comments. Yes, Shyam Suna. Once in New York, the extermination of the roaches in the kitchen became a subject. Do you know what Prabhupada said? Well, I know generally, I have some example of what Prabhupada said about these things. I was once being harassed, I've told this story, by mosquitoes in Vrindavan. And especially they were in the bathroom, because the bathrooms are always wet, and that, especially in our Krishna Balaram guest house. The bathrooms have no windows, so they're always damp. And mosquitoes like damp atmosphere. So I was getting bitten up like crazy, and finally I lost control, and I just started swatting all the mosquitoes. So naturally, after that, I felt very guilty, and I was Prabhupada's secretary. I went to Srila Prabhupada, and I said, Srila Prabhupada, I have to own up to the fact that I must have just killed about 20 mosquitoes. And Prabhupada shook his head and said, that's not very good. I wasn't very pleased with that. I said, well, you know, what can we do in these circumstances? And Prabhupada said, prevention. He said we should try to prevent these things from taking place ahead of time so that when we find ourselves in such a circumstance, we don't just act, you know, by instinct, you know, animal instinct. So for that regard, with cockroaches, Prabhupada said, in general, he said, keep the place very clean. That will at least, to some degree, control the number. That's what he used to say, prevention. Put screens on your houses so you don't get the mosquitoes inside or flies inside. Keep your kitchen. Don't collect garbage in the kitchen, for example. Garbage is supposed to be taken out after each time you cook. Sometimes I'm astonished to see people leave garbage in kitchen. The garbage is unclean, and it attracts all kinds of rodents and roaches. So if you're very, very clean, you know, at least you can reduce the number. Of course, it's difficult, no doubt. Like when we used to live in New York City, it didn't matter. You could have the cleanest apartment in the building, but the roaches are in every other apartment, and they just keep coming back. Roaches are prehistoric, they say. They're the hardiest creatures of all. There was some story someone told me about some roach ate the copper, the rubber covering some copper wiring, and as a result there was a short and a building burned down. And, you know, the building burned down, and the roach is all just, you know, the roach had not just walked away from the fire. Yeah, they can't. It's very hard for these things to get annihilated. Yes, that's a good point Prajapati Prabhu has made, that, you know, even if you take every precaution, it's impossible to avoid killing. Just like now, as you breathe, there are microbes in the air which you are breathing and killing. When you sat down, you know, you probably squished all kinds of microbes. So, you know, you're like death personified for all, you know, for billions of living entities. How to overcome, in other words, all of this karma, there has to be sacrifice. So the sacrifice, of course, is Sankirtan sacrifice. The glorification of Krishna through the spreading of the Sankirtan movement counteracts. In this age, this is the method for counteracting sins which are impossible to avoid. To live in this world means to commit sin. It is impossible to be totally sinless because inadvertently, there are sins committed. But if we engage in Sankirtan, if we spread this Krishna consciousness movement, this is Sankirtan Yajna, and this Yajna will alleviate any and remove and neutralize any sinful reactions. Yes, Sarvabhauma.
Maharaj, which one?
The same one.
Yes. Yes. Because the bird was sinless. I mean, the bird was sinlessness, not, and it's not sinless, but the bird was not, had not done anything wrong. The bird was in a helpless condition, and the point being made here is that the bird took shelter. Yeah, so I guess what your real question is, what if someone took shelter and they had committed a murder? Well, we'd have to see if they were really taking shelter. I mean, Kali really took shelter of Prakshit Maharaj and he didn't kill him. And what Kali was doing, he was supposed to be killed. He was attacking a cow and a bull. So he had every reason to be killed and he didn't kill him. The problem is that they don't take shelter. So I guess your question is a valid question. What would our policy be in regard to a murderer if he actually took shelter of a proper person? But here we have to understand that taking shelter means that you are prepared to do whatever the person you take shelter of tells you to do. And we don't see that criminals can do that. They stopped being a devotee. Yeah, someone was a prisoner in prison, became interested in Krishna consciousness. As soon as they get out, bang, back to their old ways. Just like there was another example even of a devotee who, famous devotee, not famous, but he was famous by, or infamous for what he finally did. He was a devotee and he was discovered to apparently have cancer. So, you know, he went all over the college campuses advertising, I have six months left to live. Please hear me speak. And he would speak about Krishna. And then eventually he went to Mayapur to live out his last days. And Prabhupada, you know, gave him the only time Prabhupada ever awarded anyone Babaji. Made him a Babaji. And then somehow or other, he had taken some tests in America, before he left India. And he got word that the tests were negative. They actually didn't have cancer. And as soon as he heard this, he immediately flew back to America, found his old girlfriend, bought a sports car, and, you know, gave up his Babaji title. So, it's sort of like the example of the elephant taking a bath and then coming out of the lake and rolling around in the dust. You know, or Prabhupada says the cure for syphilis Venereal disease is very painful, but even after undergoing the cure, people go out and have illicit sex again. In other words, unless you uproot the desire for sinning, even any kind of prayaschitta or atonement will not purify the heart. This question was asked by Maharaj Pritchard to Sukadeva Goswami. He said, what is the use of atonement, of punishment, if we see that the criminals, even after getting punished, go out and commit the same crime again? What is the use of, you know, just like we see, so many people go to church to confess their sins, they're told to do such and such atonement, and then they go out and do the sin all over again. He said, what value? And Sukadeva Goswami agreed with him, and therefore gave the example that actually, if you want to be freed from sin, then he gave the example of Ajamil, how Ajamil was, gradually the whole story's come out, not only of Ajamil, but of Prahlad Maharaj, etc., that chanting of the holy names of the Lord uproots the tendency to commit sin. Chanting uproots the tendency to commit sin. This is mentioned in the beginning of Nectar Devotion. That the benefit of chanting is that not only does it neutralize karma, but it uproots the very desire to do sin. Yes.
This is a little off topic, but sometimes during preaching, Kami will try to argue that the pleasure one gets by practicing Krishna consciousness, like by being in Sankirtana, is simply due to the secretion of chemicals in the body, and that in a sense it's no different than exercising or doing some other activity that requires.
So if someone says that the pleasure from chanting is no different than exercising or anything else. That's a material argument. The question is really whether or not there is a separate self. Some materialists say there isn't. That consciousness is simply a result of the combination of chemicals or atoms, etc. And of course, that's the position of modern science. It's basically the same argument. We have to discuss whether or not what is the source of consciousness. So it's not a simple response. That's all. I mean, what you're saying is the same. It all breaks down to the same argument. So we have to give our arguments against material scientific conceptions that the soul or the self is something transcendent. The consciousness is not a result of material combination. Anyway, there's books on that you can read if you want arguments. Neither is their arguments are not totally convincing either. They have no proof that consciousness arises from material combination. They cannot demonstrate that. Consciousness is a big field of study now, mainly because it's wide open for investigation, and it's not. Nothing is very certain or confirmed in this field. So I think the best thing is just to break it down to the simple point, and you know, the question is consciousness. Where does consciousness originate from? What is it that's conscious?
Could one argue with such people, could one try to argue that the pleasure, I mean, is there some way that would appeal to such a person that they could demonstrate that the pleasure of
I think that they're still going to say, whatever you want to say about the pleasures are just the interaction of neurons, you know, neurons firing away in the brain. So it's not real. But I think the basic point we can just say is then eat your philosophy. In other words, you can break down everything to simply neurons firing the brain. So why did you go to the movie? Why do you do this? Why do you do that? Why do you bother living? If you eat your own philosophy. If you really believe it, live it. We don't believe it, but if you believe that, then why are you doing all these things? If ultimately there's no value to anything, no intrinsic value to anything, it's just chemicals interacting, why bother to live? if there's no meaning to life. I think you can show them just from a, you know, getting in on that level that they're not prepared to actually live out that type of philosophy. So although they speak of it hypothetically and intellectually, in reality they don't live that way. They very much do have preferences. One thing is better than another. I like this food. I don't like that food. I like to exercise. I. You know, and let's see. You know, yeah. Prabhupada makes the simple point. He makes the point that no one cries when chemicals are poured down a sink drain. You know, but if your child is injured, you start wailing. Why? If it's just chemicals. So I mean, you know. Nice theory, but it doesn't hold in real life. People don't live like that. It's late. Let us stop now. We'll stop. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai.